This is Radioactive, a weekly grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for November 8th, 2012. This is Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we look at some of the history of solar power in the U.S. with the director of the Maine Solar Energy Association. Next week we'll look at the implementation of solar power at the residential level. As so-called Superstorm Sandy illustrates the impacts of climate change on the gathering intensity of weather patterns, we are looking towards on-the-ground solutions. Last week, we spoke with Maine Partners for Cool Communities, and this week, we begin a conversation with the director of the Maine Solar Energy Association, Dr. Richard Comp. Next week, we'll speak with Comp about solar water heating, photovoltaic systems, passive solar, solar cookers, and other ways to utilize solar at the local level. Today, we begin our conversation looking at the history of solar power, a history which closely follows Rich Comp's own biography. We'll pause our conversation at one point during the program to thank anyone calling for this pledge drive. So we have with us today Dr. Richard Comp, the director of the Maine Solar Energy Association, based out of Jonesport in Washington County. Welcome to the program.
Well, it's very nice to be on the air at WERU again. Been a while.
It's great to have you. Today we want to talk about solar energy, both in the context of climate change and energy autonomy. You have been working on advocating for implementing small-scale solar energy for decades now. Can you first give us a little of your background, and then we'll get into the larger picture and also looking at the smaller-scale implementation opportunities?
Oh, yes. Well, I started working on solar energy professionally in 1960 when I went to Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan, and my research work involved using a proton beam, a particle beam accelerator, to make what are called cuprous oxide Schottky barrier cells. I'm not going into the physics of those, except to say that they're very thin film cells made with sub-nanomaterial. There's no silicon involved. Cuprous oxide was the first photovoltaic material. Becquerel made cells, but they weren't very good. In 1839 is when he made the first of these cells. I learned how to make much better cells than he had had. And then when I finished my work, I went to work at Xerox Corporation because in 1964, nobody was interested in hiring somebody because the only place they used solar cells was in the space program, and they didn't use many of them. They were silicon cells. And then while I was at Xerox, I learned how to use organic semiconductors and make a paint-on plastic solar cells, which are getting fashionable nowadays. I wrote, did scientific work on these organic semiconductor dyes, like the Rodemann dye. That's called Rodemann because it's in the rods of your eye. But again, we used them in the copying machines and laser printers, fax machines, things like that. But I didn't get to do anything with solar cells just to generate power until I left and went to work. I was a professor of physics and astronomy at Western Kentucky University starting in 1968 until they fired me in 1973. It was the Vietnam War era, and a whole batch of us got fired at the same time for objecting to the war prematurely. So then I ended up back at Wayne State when Gerald Ford was president. He was actually a big advocate of renewable energy. So in 1975, I went back to Detroit and worked, and Detroit was in very bad shape. That's when I was living with this girlfriend, Winnie, in an abandoned skyscraper in downtown Detroit.
Wow.
Strange place. But we worked on thin film nanomaterial solar cells almost exclusively back then. And finally, Ronald Reagan got elected, and that was the end of all that work, because Jimmy Carter kept up the work. My entire salary was based on government grant money. I was one of the 47% parasites, I guess. And then after Ronald Reagan got elected, that was the end of salaries for me.
And so you have been working professionally with photovoltaics since around 1960, you said?
Yes, all the way through from 1960 to now. Basically, all my research has to do with the interaction of materials with sunlight, yes. Photovoltaic cells, solar water heaters, solar air heaters, solar cookers. And 1975, I started working on hybrids. My house here is off the grid. I haven't paid a electric or a heating bill in 25 years now. And I get the hot water from my house from a hybrid that makes hot water and electricity at the same time using water-cooled solar cells.
So we're going to want to break down a number of these different solar avenue options, which a number of people in the state as well as across the country already employ. But maybe before we jump into that, since we were talking about history a little bit, can you talk about the history of solar power in this country, what movement there has been over the decades? You just alluded to some, and why you feel it has not taken root even in the face of increasingly unignorable climate change?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, both the use of solar energy and the knowledge of climate change goes all the way back to the 19th century. The solar trough-type solar collectors used to generate steam and generate power goes back to the middle of the 19th century in the United States. We've always been the pioneers in it. A guy named Ericsson, who also took the screw propeller and made a ironclad ship during the Civil War called the Monitor. He made a great big trough-type solar concentrator to generate steam to run power. And then after that, you have people working on all kinds of solar thermal systems. Passive solar architecture, of course, was used in the United States since the beginning of the United States. That goes back thousands of years. The knowledge of exactly how and where to put your windows. Lots of very old main homes, salt box design, are actually passive solar homes. That way they don't have to cut quite so much wood in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all solar thermal, and towards the end of the 19th century, there were these parabolic concentrator solar power systems for instance, there was an ostrich farm in California that had a great big one, and then started using them to generate electricity and so forth. Lots of work in the 1890s in this area, and of course the past. Frank Lloyd Wright always built solar homes. He called them natural homes. And the when I was a kid, in fact, that's how I got into solar energy. My parents moved to a suburb of Chicago in 1951. And they had, it was the summer of 1950, I think we moved. They were building passive solar homes right in the neighborhood where my parents moved.
Again, so which neighborhood was
that? The architects and everything.
Where was that again?
In Park Forest, south of Chicago. Remember, it always happens first in Chicago, and then about a quarter century later, they'll invent it in New York, and then it actually happens. So anyway, particularly in architecture, that's true. So I got to know solar energy then, and when I went to go to graduate school, instead of working on solar thermal systems, because they already had solar water heaters and everything pretty well developed. They were developed in the 19th century in England, the batch type ones, because the British took their baths in the evening, just as the sun goes down, before they dressed for dinner, whereas the Americans took showers in the morning. And, of course, the batch heaters on the roof were dead cold by then. So somebody developed the day and night water heater, which have a separate collector and tank, and they were very common. My friend in Florida has this framed advertisement for, in fact, it was from another friend's apartment, old 1920s apartment in Florida, which was bragging about its state-of-the-art solar water heaters for the apartment. They were the most common type of water heater in the United States. They had millions of them. In the 1950s, the tanks started leaking because they were galvanized iron and they didn't know enough about electrolysis. And too cheap to meter nuclear power was right around the corner. Uh-huh. So they started getting rid of these old-fashioned solar water heaters in places like Florida and the Southwest United States, to replace by modern electric water heaters. Except in the slums of Miami and places like that, I have met Cuban and other Latinos who are living in these slums now, and they say it's marvelous in the United States. You get free hot water. Well, not everybody gets free hot water.
Now, at the turn of the century, or the other turn of the century, there were there not a number of solar company upstarts and like you were saying, housing stock that was specifically being made to have solar power? Where did that movement go?
Well, what happened, of course, as I said, the people in places like Santa Barbara, California, if you had a solar water heater on your house, this is in the 1930s, they wouldn't hook your house up to a gas line until you took the solar water heater off.
And why was that, do you think?
Because they didn't want the competition. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, having carbon establishment control what you do goes way back. But and then photovoltaics never really did anything until after World War II. Bell Labs people accidentally discovered the silicon solar cell, which is the standard one today for 90-some percent of all the installations. During the early part of World War II, a guy named Ulp did it, but it was all top secret work for the radar work. So no one ever talked about it. And then after the war, they invented it. My mentor, the person I worked with, actually worked on photovoltaics during World War II before it was invented by Bell Labs. They say Becquerel did in 1839, however, and other people did it in the 19th century. Then the space program is where now I'll go into the modern history of photovoltaics.
Yes.
Space program in the 1950s, late 50s and 60s, was the place where it was being used, and it's the only place, with one exception. Exxon was a company that became Exxon, started using photovoltaic panels on the oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico because it was the most reliable and cheapest way to operate the red flashing lights on the oil rigs, which is interesting. So there's a company called Tideland Signal that was building these things. And except for the space program, that was it until the 1970s. And then during the oil embargo took place, and we started wondering about using what we called alternative energy. Now, mm-hmm. Of course, renewable energy is the normal energy. We have 10,000 years of civilization, approximately. And in those 10,000 years, by the time we stop using fossil fuels, either because we thoroughly wreck the atmosphere or we run out of the stuff, we'll only have used it for 300 out of the 10,000 years. So anyway, they started doing it, and when I went back to Wayne State in the 1970s, it was because Gerald Ford actually put a lot of government money into renewable energy. He really liked renewables, solar and wind particularly. And I got called back to Wayne State to restart the lab with Dan Tribbage, my mentor, in Detroit in 1975, a couple of years before I got elected, you know.
And was Ford concentrating more on R&D, or where was the implementation there?
They R&D and applications both. They were trying to get things going and getting them out and being used and get the price down.
What were some examples of application at that point?
Well, what we worked on was all thin film materials. And for instance...
And this was for residential or...
They were for everything.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't separating what they were going to be used for. That's when I invented the hybrid, which makes hot water and electricity at the same time, which is what I use in my house.
And can you briefly say what a hybrid is?
When you have solar cells, if you put twice as much light on a solar cell, you get twice as much electric current out of it. Twice as many photons going in, twice as many electrons coming out. But the cell overheats and the voltage drops and the cell becomes less efficient. So on my roof I have aluminum fins with copper tubes in the back, and you run cooling water through the tubes and keep the cells cool. And then I have aluminum reflectors doubling the amount of light that falls on the cell to double the current. And so you make hot water and electricity at the same time. That's something that somebody just this morning sent me a paper. People in Oxford University have just invented this.
Something that you...
Very shortly, and they have a company that's going to try to go into production.
Just
I've
invented something.
I've been trying to get the Passamaquoddy Indian Nation over in Pleasant Point to go into production. We had a workshop at their place where we built one of these solar water hybrids, and they were quite excited about it, but then nothing much has happened. This is 2-3 years ago we did it.
Mm-hmm.
So we may be doing it in Washington County before Oxford University is doing it. But anyway, they're now catching on to these things. But we worked on, for instance, cadmium telluride, cadmium sulfide solar cells. And by the way, the amount of cadmium in the cadmium telluride solar cell is less than the amount of cadmium that's in the red ink in the colored parts of your newspaper, like your comic strip. So it's not a problem. Until about 3 years ago, the world's largest photovoltaic manufacturing factory was in Toledo, Ohio. All this work, cadmium telluride work and everything, as well as most of silicon work and all the other materials, was virtually all done in the United States. But after Ronald Reagan came in, of course, all the research work was stopped dead. In the U.S., but kept up in other places. By the way, they are the cheapest solar cells to manufacture. Now I'll go jump to more of the present. The Chinese are in this in a really big way.
As we've said at the top of the program, we're going to be speaking in greater detail about how to implement many of these different solar systems in people's residential homes and how they can do that. But in kind of finishing up a bit, even though obviously the history is enormous, but continue to give us that idea. We were talking about how under Ford, when we're looking at the policy, but please bring into context the influence, as you alluded to earlier, of how corporate pressure has played a role in suppressing the development of solar power, both small scale and larger scale in the country. But just if you can sort of synopsize how, you know, you were saying that we were seeing much more of a movement for research and development and implementation of applications of these inventions under Ford and then Carter. How far did we get? And again, underline, how did that get suppressed under the Reagan administration and presumably pressures from other industries?
Well, of course, Jimmy Carter started the Department of Energy and had a lot of money for the renewables, both research and development and the more implementation of them. But when Ronald Reagan got elected, that was the end of all the money. He simply eliminated it by taking all the money away. And, of course, you know, Jimmy Carter put solar water heaters on the White House, and Ronald Reagan took them off. And the pop quiz I like to give people is, do you know where they are now? Except for one that Bill McKibben took away. The rest of them are on the dining hall at Unity College in Unity, Maine.
That's right.
We had
right.
a really nice workshop where we refurbished those and taught people how to make their own solar water heaters.
Great, and definitely we're looking forward to the next segment with you where we talk about how people really can implement, because that's a big part of what you do is education and workshops that really show people how they can make their own as well as put new systems into their homes. Let's talk about the influence of oil companies and that pressure.
Well, the oil companies, as they say, got involved for their own use early on, but they also, Shell, for example, has bought up three small solar companies already in its history over the decades and has shut them all down. One case, they transferred it to another group in Germany that's still running it. That was originally Arco Solar, because Arco owned the company. Arco bought it, and then the Shell bought it from Arco, and Siemens had it for a while. Now it is, I don't know, it's a group of people in Germany have it. General Electric bought out a company called, we used to get a lot of cells from them, and they had a new method of making solar cells, which I thought was going to be even cheaper than the first solar system. And
so they bought
Astro Power is the name of the company in Wilmington, Delaware, and GE bought them up and shut them down. And the process, I talked with the GE vice president, and he said he didn't know what I was talking about the special way of making silicon thin film cells. He says they don't have such a thing. Unfortunately, I had a working sample, so I know that they really did have it at one time. So this happens. The carbon establishment, in fact, is getting very worried, because the cheapest way to build a build a new power plant is wind, and photovoltaics, because the price has dropped so much, is second. I can go into the price, for instance, dollars per watt. The cheapest of the photovoltaics is the cadmium telluride cells, which cost about 50 cents per watt for a completely finished module. Then about 60, 65 cents for the crystalline silicon modules nowadays. And they're selling for less than a dollar a watt, the ones coming from China. To put this in perspective, a brand new coal-fired power plant costs about $3.80-some per watt to build. And then you have to buy coal to put in it, which, of course, is part of the idea for that carbon establishment. Nuclear power plants run about $12 per watt instead of 50 cents per watt. The only justification for a country to build nuclear power plants is to make bomb material. There's no other reason to do it. Nowadays, it's just so incredibly expensive. If you completely ignore all the environmental concerns about nuclear power and everything, banks won't loan any money for it, because it's just too damned expensive for the bean counters. And, of course, that's why you have to have large government subsidies by the taxpayer for nuclear power in order to get it to compete. And fossil fuels also have large subsidies on them. 100-year-old subsidies on oil, in order to develop the oil industry. And we're already peaked out. 6-7 years ago, we peaked out in conventional oil, the pumping of it.
So we're going to...
Now they're getting the dregs.
Right. And so we're going to have to now wrap up this segment. We're going to be talking again with you in greater detail about, like we said, the individual initiatives that people can take in this state. And real quick, anything else for this segment that you'd like to add?
Well, I want to tell you, I'm part of the Maine Solar Energy Association, and you can go to our website, which is www.mainesolar.com. All run together as one word, .org, MAINESOLAR.ORG. And you can read the reports I've written, and you can also see our calendar of events. We have lots of workshops and activities like that where you can build your own solar water heaters, solar air heaters, photovoltaic modules. We had two nice workshops in October. But there's going to be no more workshops here until next April, I believe, although some of our members are doing workshops in places like New York City, and I'm doing one for the University of Florida in Fort Myers, Florida, in December.
Thanks for joining us for the first part of our conversation with Dr. Richard Comp, the director of the Maine Solar Energy Association, and we'll be talking with you in more detail for next week's program as well. Thank you. Again, join us next week for a look at solar power residential application. And you've been listening to Radioactive, a weekly environmental and social justice news journal on your community radio, WERU-FM. To give feedback, you can call the station or email news@weru.org. To listen to Radioactive archives, you can go to weru.org. Thanks for listening and acting.